Recordings are started.
Thank you, Carol. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the IRTP Part D Working Group call on the 19th of May, 2014. On the call today, we have Volker Greeman, James Bledel, Barbara Knight, and Christine Dorian. We have apologies from Paul Diaz, Angie Graves, Holly Raich, and Avery Doria. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Marika Konings, Amy Bivens, Barry Cobb, and Steve Chan, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, James.
Thank you, and welcome everyone to IRTPD Working Group Call for 19th of May. Just a quick note here. First off, do we have anyone with any updates to their statements of interest? If so, please get my attention or raise your hand. Okay, seeing none. As I was noting before the call started, I may have to drop here at 30 past the hour. So if necessary, we can either end the call a little early or we can turn it over to Lars and Barry. I'm sure that they would be happy to take the wheel from there on in. We did, therefore, move the agenda around a little bit from what was sent to the list earlier in that we moved the work plan up and then to the second item and then everything else dropped below. So if anyone has any other thoughts on that agenda, please let me know. Otherwise, we'll just proceed through that. We'll see how far we get. I see that Bob has joined as well. Hi, Bob. So let's move into item number two, which is where we wanted to discuss our work plan. Particularly, we want to see how close we are up to various deadlines triggered by the London meeting and what sort of number of meetings will remain open to us, number of calls, and what we have left to do. And I think that the group then needs to decide whether we want to continue to push to release a final report in London. We could certainly, if we miss London, we could certainly put out our final report somewhere in the vicinity so that folks have it and it's open for comment when they get back from London. Certainly all of those items, all those options are on the table. But let's take a look right now. Today we have the 19th of May. Next Monday is a bank holiday in the UK and public holiday in the US. So I think we should probably determine now whether we want to continue to have a call next week. Just scanning the list here, I can see that we will probably lose everyone but one or two of the folks that are currently attending, and I would consider this to be the core list of participants. So it feels like we're probably not going to be able to have a call next week, but I would certainly, I can be persuaded on that point. That leaves us then the 2nd of June, the 19th of June, or sorry, the 9th of June, and then the 15th of June, which is a Sunday. This would be the deadline to present a motion for the GMFO Council meeting. I don't think, even in our most optimistic schedules, I don't think we were ready to bring this to the GMFO Council, but we could certainly use that as a, putting a stake in the ground as something that we should be shooting for. And then, Lars, I presume then the 16th of June is the last date before, and I can tell this group that I will already be in transit to Europe. I have a meeting before the London conference, so I will not be available for the 16th of June. So it seems like we have today and two more calls. I will just kind of open it for discussion here. It feels like we're probably not going to be able to publish a final report in advance of the London meeting. However, I think that we can still track towards a final report in the vicinity of the London meeting, either at the meeting or shortly thereafter, with the idea that it would be open for comment for most of the month of July, and then that this working group would then be on hiatus for at least a couple weeks during July. So that's my thinking at this point. Certainly open to suggest. I'm sorry, the other alternative would be that if the group feels very strongly that we should be targeting publication of the final report before London, then the option would be to take those next two calls, the June call 2nd and the June 9th call, and turn those into perhaps 90-minute or two-hour sessions. I don't know how folks would feel about that. You know, I think that nobody likes the prospect of hanging out on an ICANN PDP call for a couple hours. But on the other hand, you know, if it doesn't drag things out, it, you know, we actually can use those 2 hours to finish up, and then that's certainly something that we can consider. So does anyone have any thoughts which way, one way or the other, how they'd like to see this play out? I do feel that we're very close. I feel that we have a little more work to do than we have in previous groups, and that's a good thing because I think that we received both in terms of quantity and quality, we received a higher level of public feedback from our initial report than we saw for IRTPB and IRTPC. And so I think that's what's driving some of the schedule slip is that, you know, that we really have to digest those comments that we receive. So anyone else have any thoughts on this? Any preference towards really kind of putting our foot to the gas and trying to extend those last two calls, or should we just kind of make our peace with the idea right now that we will not be presenting a final report in London, but perhaps shortly thereafter? We have a couple folks in the queue, so first off, we will go to Bob. Bob?
Yeah, I'm torn. I mean, it's nice to have a deadline to finish stuff, but I think going leading up to London, we all have so much going on. There's HostingCon the week before London. I might be in favor of sort of raising the white flag a little bit and just setting a realistic deadline after ICANN and just keep our current meeting cadence up my 2 cents.
Thanks, Bob. I think that's certainly a valid perspective. Volker?
Yes, as I'm working with Glenn on preparing the meeting plan and schedules for the London meeting for the Genus Old Council as well, it would be helpful and worthwhile to just estimate if we will have something and have that information as soon as possible so that we can either work for a final report or work with the assumption that we have more time available and then maybe use less of the council time for presentation if we don't have something final to present already. So anything that you can give us in advance of June 15th, which would be very last minute, would be helpful for us planning the schedules.
Thanks, Volker. Noted that there's still... We're well underway in terms of planning the agenda both for the Saturday sessions and the general meeting. I put myself in the queue mostly to agree with Bob and to throw another thing out on the table for consideration is that we are still working, some of us working with ICANN staff to implement IRTPC. So if we were to, let's say, push hard for a publication of a final report, we should do so knowing that it would probably not accelerate the implementation of any recommendations that come out of this working group or that are adopted by the council and the board. In fact, they would, and apologies to some of the folks from staff, but I think they recognize just the challenges that we're facing is that it would essentially go into a pipeline of yet-to-be-deployed PDP changes relative to IRTP. So I don't know that there's any external pressure to drive this. In fact, I think that one of our recommendations will be to circle back to IRTPC implementation and take a look at dispute mechanisms attached to change of registrant. So I think, you know, where am I going with this? I don't really think that it's in our best interest necessarily to rush this for the finish line. In fact, I think that that may end up with us putting let's say less than thorough. I think the quality would suffer if we targeted London. That's probably the simplest way to say it. So I'll drop my hand here. I think, does anyone disagree with just essentially treating these next two meetings as typical one-hour meetings, perhaps having a working session in London and driving towards a publication of our final report in the early July timeframe, with the understanding that it would be open for comments, as Barry has noted that there is a council meeting July 24th, and that there is then no council meeting in August, so probably September would be the next GNSO council meeting that something like this can be voted on. So I saw a hand go up and I saw a hand go down. Is that you, Lars? You want to weigh in on this? Or?
Yeah, just because you brought in August. Just very quickly, yeah. So the next meeting after London is July, as Barry said. So if we were to aim for that, that would give us, if we don't have a meeting on the 16th of June, because some might be already in transit, the week after is the ICANN week, obviously, and the Monday after people will again be in transit. So the first meeting will then be the 7th of July, with the 14th already being the deadline the week after. So essentially that would just give us one extra session, plus the meeting in London itself. So then we'd be looking indeed in September, at September. The motion deadline for that is being the 15th.
Yeah, and I don't think that would be enough time to allow for a comment period and the potential that we would, again, receive some substantive comments. I mean, it's possible, but I think that we are now looking at final report with comments and polishes, let's say, submitted to council with a motion for their September meeting. Oh, there's no need for a comment period. I keep forgetting that. I always think there has to be a comment period on the final. Sorry. So Lars has corrected me on that. Okay. Well, let's target this. Perhaps we could again use if we do have a slot on the agenda, we can use that for a working session in London. If we can obtain or secure a 60-minute or even a 90-minute session, we can probably finish up the last bits of the drafting and go from there. So I'm trying to keep one eyeball on the chat here. Staff is putting some very important notes here, and very notes that if only recommendations would change, then another public comment period might be desirable. So, Lars notes, we have requested a 90-minute slot, and we'll let the group know as soon as we pin down the time and date. So, I've proposed let's do that. Let's tackle today and the next two meetings. Let's tackle in 90 minutes in London, and hopefully that will give us enough time to incorporate the feedback that we have received and finish up some of these loose ends. Okay. All right, so next on the agenda, we had a review of FOA-related transfer numbers. Now, those of you remember that Rob Golding was essentially, I think, agreeing with one of the comments, Arthur, that the FOA was was a source of numerous transfer problems or issues and did not necessarily offer the expected offsetting benefits, to transfers and to untangling transfer disputes. I don't have, so let's go through his numbers here, and I think other registrars ask, as a takeaway to try and gather similar numbers. So by Rob here, we have approximately 4,000 transfers requested, approximately 2,700 transfers completed, and we had about 29 transfers actually canceled. We had about 1,130 transfers failed at least once due to FOA issues. Looks like just under 1,000 did not receive, did not understand, or did not realize the FOA was part of the process. Now, I'm a little confused by this next statement here. They did not realize they needed to follow the FOA from the losing registrar. The losing registrar sending out the FOA, to my understanding, is optional, and there was really no action required on the part of the registrant. My understanding, the transfer cannot be held up due to the fact that the FOA from the losing registrar was not completed. I think that that is more of a courtesy notification than an actual something that's on the critical path of the transfer. So he goes on to say that at least 188 transfers needed the FOA sent at least 5 times, DFS, spam, filters, whitelists, et cetera. So there were certainly some problems in delivering the FOA once it was requested. Every one of these transfers had ordered and paid where necessary, except the terms and conditions applied to EPP, auth info code, all the things on the inbound FOA, as you cannot start a transfer without the EPP code, and the FOA predates them by about 10 years. In my opinion, it's become the de facto replacement for standardized email for the gaining registrar. And I think that, looking at Rob's numbers here, I visited with our team to gather some similar statistics from our team. I was not able to do so in time for this call, but I will tell you that the reaction from the team, particularly the team that handles transfer problems, was that the FOAs were, I'll just say that they agreed much more along the lines of the comment that we saw from ICANN compliance rather than what we're seeing from Rob and from Arthur, which is that FOAs are essential in those cases when something goes wrong with the transfer process, and that without them there would be nothing in order to that they would be flying blind in their efforts to untangle or resolve disputed or erroneous transfers. So that's feedback from us. I don't know if any other registrars had a chance. The only other registrar on the call, I believe, today is Volker. Volker, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but have you had a chance to gather some? I know you have a slightly different model as a reseller based registrar, but go ahead, let us know what you got.
Yes, I also didn't get any numbers so far. I've asked our tech team to let those numbers run, but they're currently busy implementing new GTLDs, so they have other things to worry about than getting statistics out for me. Sorry for that. An additional issue is that as we are working as a reseller registrar for a large majority of our business, it's also sometimes not clear if a transfer was requested by a reseller, by a registrant himself, or a third party that had access to the auth code when we send out the FOA. So we really rely on the FOA as a verification. In some cases, we do see that FOAs are not clicked for good reasons. So when we have the statistics looking from that Rob gave us here, I would put the in our case the transfers requested by registrants. I would put the requested by registrants in bracket because we can only in good faith assume that they were requested by registrants, but we really don't know because we don't have the direct contact with the entity that requested the transfer.
Okay, thank you, Volker. So, and I get that response quite a bit as well whenever I ask our internal teams for statistics or anything else. It's, we're 100% consumed on, market-based activities like new GTLDs. So my question then is to the group and to Volker, where do we want to go with this here? I think we have one participant of the working group and one of the public commenters essentially disagreeing with one of our findings and one of our recommendations that the FOAs are still necessary and cannot be replaced by the auth info code. On the other side of the coin, we have, I think, a fairly compelling case made by ICANN compliance and some of the other registrars on the working group. So, I don't mean to test for consensus at this point, but I think that we need to determine where the folks on the working group who have not yet weighed in what their opinions are and whether or not they believe that this is, you know, that our original recommendation should stand. So I'll go to, looks like we've got Christine and Bob. So Christine, you're first.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. And my question, I'm going to answer your, I guess not answer your question, but respond to your question with another question. From the provider's standpoint, as we're doing domain name disputes or the transfer disputes, the panelists have to be provided with a certain amount of information to determine if the transfer was fraudulent or not. Or, you know, was authorized by the underlying people that were supposed to authorize it. In the absence of the FOA, because I know analysts rely on it, as ICANN Compliance pointed out, in the absence of the FOA, what does this group imagine the panelist who's not a registrar and oftentimes is not even a domain name registrant but is a lawyer or a judge or someone who's used to taking factual information and making a decision based on that factual information, what does this group think that the panel would rely on if there was no FOA to rely on? So I hesitate to say that fine, do away with the FOA if there's nothing else, no evidence for the panel to rely on in making these determinations.
Thanks, Christine. It's an excellent point. I will attempt to respond. I think that both commenters are suggesting that the auth info code would be sufficient to successfully authorize a transfer, and the possession of the auth info code would be a clear indication that one was authorized to proceed with the transfer. And I guess that and I think this came up in one of our previous calls, was that the registrar would then be required, and this would be an interesting question for enforcement and implementation, but the registrar would be required to track who requested the auth info code and to whom it was delivered and when and where and what IP address they logged into it, et cetera. So I believe it would all fall then on the auth info code. And if our dearly departed co-chair Mikey were on the call, he would note that he has frequently called the auth info code overloaded because it's doing too many things. And this would be, whether you agree with that statement or not, this is certainly adding a new dimension to the uses of the auth info code.
Yeah, so I don't want to preempt Bob's question, but can I ask a follow up? So what, as I understand it though, the FOA was sort of making sure that the person who requested the auth info code was really who they said they were. Am I wrong in understanding that that's what the FOA is?
Well, the FOA is directed to either the registrant or the transfer, the admin contact. The auth info code could be granted both to a, both those parties, perhaps to anyone that had access to the registrar account, and possibly even unknown parties like a reseller. So, I think that's the concern. You know, that's the concern that other folks, I'll just say myself and other folks, have raised, is that the auth info code is important to execute the transfer, but the FOA is sort of this out-of-band green light that, you know, is explicitly authorized by a known party. So I hope that helps. I'm going to jump to Lars first, and then we'll go back to you with Bob and Volker. Lars?
Yep, thank you.
I just pulled up the graphic.
I'm sorry, Lars, can you hold for just a moment, please? Can you go back on mute for a second? Lars, just when you were speaking there, I don't know if it was just me, but it's incredible buzzing noise to the point where it just drowned out everything you were trying to say. Okay, looks like it wasn't just me. Can you try again, and then otherwise we may force you to type it in.
Is this better?
Much, thank you.
Okay, it might have been something with my speakers, I have no idea. I pulled up the graphic that Steve Chen drew up during the last week, which might be helpful for this discussion, which shows in which positions exactly, I'm going to unsync it so you can move the cursor left and right. I send this on the mailing list too. So it shows where the FOA comes in. And so it might be helpful, A, to understand exactly what the use is, and also it might be helpful to add to the group's argument one way or the other why it should be kept or why it shouldn't be kept. And Steve,
thank you, Lars.
He can also talk you through, I'm sure.
Thank you, Lars, and thank you, Steve. I think we'll leave this up here so that folks can review it while they're speaking, but I think we want to definitely go to the next person in the queue. Maybe we'll put a placeholder in to go through this chart here in just a moment. But Bob, you're up next.
Yeah, this is Bob. Yeah, I guess I'm surprised that we're getting this kind of data this late in the game. We're at the 11th hour, 59th minute, and we're getting data that is concerning, right? I mean, if we're seeing anywhere near this kind of volume of transfers being thwarted because of of FOA, then yeah, I think that merits further investigation on our part. Not to delay, I think we're making great progress, and we were just about there. So I guess I'm it's disappointing that we're finding this, getting this data this late and potentially having to, reassess where we were. Because I think that's where we're at. This data is concerning. I think the FOA is, for all the reasons we've talked about, is very important. Complements the opcode. They're both important. They're both necessary. But, I think this number of failures, I think, merits just some further analysis, is my opinion.
Thanks, Bob. I think it's a good point because it indicates, one or multiple possible conclusions. One is that we were too hasty in the first place. Two, that there's some confusion that may be specific to some registrars or some, some markets, or there may be some communications breakdowns, or that it's just not necessary. So I think yes, it definitely needs a little bit more discussion, but I want to make sure that and I think Barry has a good point here, and other folks agreeing that if we want to give serious consideration to the idea of eliminating the FOA, then this goes back to Christine's point. What takes its place is it a registrar internal log file that establishes the audit trail? Is it the panelists can use? Is there some other mechanism? Does the AuthInfo code become a two-factor key or something? What takes its place? I think the answer, certainly, hopefully everyone agrees on, is that the answer cannot be nothing. So that we would leave a vacuum there. So the next step would be Volker. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to go to two points here. First, what Bob mentioned. I agree, the numbers that Rob presented are concerning, and I hope that this is just something that only Bob's registrar or a few registrars face and is not a problem for all registrars. I would think that if this was a big problem, we would really need to see more data points from other registrars, small, big registrars, and analyze why these failures occur and have a study on that. Currently, we only have one data point. I think it's too early to say that we can extrapolate this being a problem from that one data point. It is concerning, but we would need more analysis for that. The other point is that currently the way that most registrars are set up, the FOA is the only evidenced contact with the domain holder or his admin contact in case of a transfer. The auth code, as it stands right now, can be retrieved by any member of the chain. So if you have five resellers, the auth code will be able to be seen by all five resellers and their employees. And this gives some potential for abuse, for unauthorized access to the auth code. Somebody hacking the account data would also be able to, of the registrant, will also be able to gain access to the auth code. So the FOA is currently the only point of contact where the registrar that wants to initiate a transfer has to reach out to the registrant who is in the WHOIS or his admin C and get his approval. That's, I think, the value that the FOA currently holds, and that's what also would need to be replaced besides the audit trail, the direct contact with the registrant, the proven contact with the registrant.
thank you, Volker. An important point to consider. Lars, you're up next. Lars?
Sorry, it was the wrong button. Here I am. It's Lars, for the record. James, I was just wondering whether I should reach out to Arthur and ask him, because, I mean, he obviously hinted in some data, and he works, I believe, for a registrar in Holland, too, and after Volker said, should try to get more data sets, whether I should ask him if they have he has any hard data to provide, rather than anecdotal that was part of his comment.
I think that would be worthwhile. I actually put myself in the queue for something like that to just kind of put a button on this conversation. Christine, were you in the queue as well, or was that just a green check mark agreeing with the previous comment?
I'm sorry, that was just a green check mark agreeing with the previous comment. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm going to try to get rid of my hands here.
So I think that Volker and Lars, you summarized where I was going with this, which is that putting myself in the queue as a registrar, I think that, you know, all of the internal issues that I've heard, you know, is that the SOAs are invaluable and that they were not necessarily seeing this level of transfer failures, but I want to get some actual statistics, and I will attempt to do so this week. And I would encourage other registrars on the working group to do the same. Volker is correct that the FOA is a way of getting to immediately to the end of the channel, end of the supply chain. So if there's one or more resellers involved, the FOA is direct contact between the registrar that's responsible for sponsoring the name and the registrant who's legally authorized to transfer the name. So I think that that is also important. It short circuits all the intermediary parties. In most cases, there are none, but in some cases, there could be several. I would point out that I think it was Barry in the chat that noted that the FOA currently serves as a two-factor authentication method. You have the Authinfo code, and you have the FOA, and I think that that's, in addition to having the audit trail, that is an important value. Or important principle, and I think that then Lars summed up what I was going to ask next, which was, could we go back to Rob and to Arthur and ask for statistics similar to what we saw from Rob, but also recommendations on if the FOA were to be eliminated, what do they envision replacing those features that we outlined, which is a externally visible, so not an internal log file, but an externally visible chain of authority for the transfer that eliminates the need to communicate through intermediary parties. And I think that's the question that we should probably put to them. And even if we, you know, circle back and land on our original recommendation, which is that FOAs are essential and we need to maintain them, then, you know, at least we will have, I think, done our due diligence by having these conversations. So, Lars, you're up.
Thank you, James. This is Lars. I was just wondering whether we should move, seeing that the group seems to be settling on needing more data and getting information from various registrars and from Arthur as well. Whether we should, seeing this the last charter question, to move this actually to July, this issue.
Hi. Lars, did we lose you?
Interesting music.
Yes, I think we lost. Lars has been replaced by some hold music here.
He moved to Hawaii.
I think he was saying something about moving to July. You know, I think that's possible, but I think that we certainly have enough in front of us in terms of action items or takeaways that we can work on immediately, and I think we should do so. Because if we can, you know, get this on buttoned up in the next two meetings, I think we should. So, you know, but I think echoing something Bob said earlier, this is, it seems to be something fairly critical that is being, you know, introduced at a fairly late stage of the game. So we should understand, is it, you know, is it a cul-de-sac here in our discussions, or is it something that we really should give possible consideration to the idea that it would cause an alteration to that recommendation. Okay. I'm sorry. Barbara put something in the chat here I think that we should probably capture as well. So we want to look at the failures based on FOA to be a positive. As it was just pointed out, the only interaction with a registered name holder, perhaps they failed because they did not authorize the transfer. I was thinking about that as well, Barbara, that mixed in with that number of failures, there could be some percentage of attempted hijackings or unauthorized transfers that were thwarted. I think that the position that Rob was maintaining was that some of those folks then reached out and contacted his support team. So at least those who did then reach out and communicate would certainly, you would presume that a hijacker wouldn't ask for support or wouldn't call for help. So it would be interesting to note that as well. And so perhaps something that other registrars like myself and Volker should endeavor to gather those and break those out of our statistics if that's even possible. So I think the point is maybe those were FOA successes. Okay. Well, I see Lars still has his hand up. Lars, have you addressed your audio problems, or do you want to play us more hula music? Or?
Well, last time you said you liked the music, James. I really don't know what to do.
No, Volker said he liked the music. Eh?
I'm sorry about that. There was a call on the other line, and I pressed the wrong button. I meant to decline, but I accepted. So there was a whole situation. I was going to just suggest that we leave the FOA discussion, but you wrap this up until really July when we have some data, seeing it's the last of the charter questions, and we can go through the other remaining issues and then return to this maybe post-London when we have
different people and also have maybe spoken to people in person, other registrars, to see what their feeling and sentiment is on this. And I will make sure to chase up people on hard data as well. That's all.
Okay. Thanks. I'm glad we could get your thoughts into the record here. I think that we should probably proceed with gathering data and going back to Arthur and to Rob with some of the questions that we outlined. I think we should leave open the opportunity that the other stuff is going to go so smoothly that we will maybe even have an opportunity to tackle this before July, potentially. And you know me, always the optimist. So I think that we've come in for a landing here on this topic. I think it is an important one, and I think we need to fully explore it, if nothing else, just to make sure that we are giving it giving these perspectives on the FOA their day and their time at the microphone, so that they can be understood and examined. Okay, the next item on our agenda, and I notice we have 20 minutes at the top of the hour. I'm probably going to have to drop here fairly shortly. So let's go to item number 4, which is reviewing a list of definitions. If possible, if I could ask Lars to put the list of definitions into the Adobe screen. Or maybe, yeah, there it is. Okay. So I don't know if we want to read through these on the call. Looks like there are 2 pages of definitions. So we can read through them individually, whatever the group thinks is the most efficient way to go through them. I think that the key here, two parts. One, read through these to understand that you agree with the definitions that's being proposed or provided with each of these terms. And two, making sure that we've caught all the terms, that there isn't something that's been orphaned out there or something that we've been using in our vernacular, in our discussions and deliberations that isn't captured in this term. So we have 19 minutes. I think we can get through these. So let's just dive right in here. And then if I have to drop, then I'll just wave in Lars. We'll go from there. So these don't appear to be in alphabetical order. I don't know. We'll decide in complainant, a party bringing a complaint under the policy. A complainant may be a losing registrar in the case of an alleged fraudulent transfer, or a gaining registrar in the case of an improper NAC, or the registrar of record. So my question to on this one is whether there's a material difference between losing registrar and registrar of record. My understanding is that the losing registrar is kind of a bit of industry jargon that we use in these working groups, but really if you look at the contract and the policy, it refers to it as the registrar of record. Can somebody help me understand the difference, Lars?
Thank you, Jen.
I can try.
Volker, you want to go ahead?
Yes, just I think what we're trying to get at here is not a redefinition of the losing registrar. I think we're trying to get at the registrar that currently holds the domain name, which may be yet another registrar from the gaining registrar. So if hops have occurred, then the registrar of record may be neither of the losing registrar and the gaining registrar. I think that's what we're trying to get at. The registrar of record is, in my definition, always the registrar where the domain name is currently sponsored.
Correct. Okay, so we are introducing the chain or the hopping scenario here with gaining, losing, and registrar of record. But the registrar of record, my understanding, maybe Christine can help me out here, the registrar of record in a multi-hop situation would not be a party to the complaint. Is my understanding. It would not be raising the complaint in the multi-hop scenario. Or maybe they could. I don't know. Christine, can you go ahead?
Yeah, to answer your question, that's probably true. Here's the deal. The registrar of record, the gaining registrar, and the registrant were already predefined terms in the original TDRP. The new term here is complainant. And the reason we added that is because the TDRP is really cumbersome. It's very complicated as you're reading it to try to figure out who the complainant is and whether or not they're the losing registrar or the gaining registrar or the registrar of record and in which situation which party is going to be the complainant. It's much easier for the panels and the people doing the dispute resolution to simply refer to the person bringing the complaint as the complainant. In their complaint, they can identify we're the losing registrar, we're the gaining registrar, whoever we are. But the point where was no definition of or use of the word complainant, which is really what the parties are what the panel's looking for. So the point of these first two definitions is to add the terms complainant and complaint and respondent, so those three, and then to tie them back to these existing definitions of gaining registrar, registrar of record, and registrant. So I just wanted to put that background piece of information in there because that was the whole point of this particular definition. So I agree with you that we're not trying to redefine losing registrar. What we're trying to do is define complainant as any one of these parties, depending on the situation as outlined in the complaint.
Okay. Thank you, Christine. That does provide, I think, some context on what we're attempting to do here. Then my recommendation would be that we maybe take a look at the language here in terms of where we have a losing registrar, a gaining registrar, or a registrar of record. I would suggest we put another or in front of a gaining registrar so that it's clear that we're talking about ors all along through this chain, if that makes sense, Lars. And maybe some folks who, went to law school instead of playing around with math can tell me why that works or why that doesn't work. Barbara.
Thank you, James. This is Barbara for the transcript. I'm wondering if we need registrar of record at all in here. If, truly, if we're referring to the registrar of record as in, the multiple hops and who's currently managing the domain name, because typically they wouldn't be the ones that would be filing a complaint. Did I misunderstand that somewhere along the line?
No, that's something I've been struggling with as well, Barbara. If they're the gaining, if there's not a multiple hop issue, then the registrar of record is the gaining registrar. So they would fall under that definition. If there is a multiple hop scenario and two registrars are disputing a transfer that doesn't involve the registrar of record, then the registrar of record would not be the complainant. So I really am struggling with the scenario where the registrar of record would be the complainant in a multi-hop situation. I'm really struggling with that.
Mikey? Hello, Mikey?
Hello.
This is Kevin Erdman.
Hi, Kevin. Okay, go ahead. The queue is clear. You have the floor.
Yeah, I was just thinking that what may have been intended by the phrase registrar of record may have been the original registrar of record in a multi-hop scenario where the, let's say, registrar who just got hijacked or complains to his registrar, who then is the one that has to bring the complaint, even though they're a few steps removed from the last transfer. So that's my thought, and I agree with all the comments that, you know, the registrar of record means the current registrar, then it seems to be superfluous since they would never bring that complaint. But if we're looking at it as being one of the earliest registrars who is no longer in the current chain, then I think that ought to be addressed and maybe addressed more clearly by saying the original registrar of record or putting in some language like that. That's my thought on it.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. So here's, those are good thoughts, and so here's what I'm proposing. I really am struggling with the idea that leaving this in here would create any harms, and it could possibly capture some scenarios that we're not able to come up with here in the next 10 minutes. So perhaps in the interest of covering all contingencies, we would just leave it in here. Is anyone opposed to that? I mean, recognizing that it's probably like some sort of thing that we really don't need. It's just an extraneous bit of language, but it if it makes us feel more comfortable, we can just leave it in here. Any objections? Volker, you're here to object.
Not really to object. I think leaving the registrar of record as part of the complainant, the definition of complainant makes no sense after what we've heard. However, I still think that the registrar of record can be a party, for example, depending on how we define it. For example, in a multi-hop scenario, when the current registrar of record, i.e. the one that holds the domain name, is not the one that brings the complaint and is also not the one that is being complained against because he did not initiate the original transfer. So that may be something that we should look at the parties, but not as the complainant.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I'm stretching with my imagination too, Volker. In fact, I was trying to think of a scenario where the registrar of record is contacted by the registrant to report that one of the earlier transfers should be disputed, and they're therefore raising the complaint against two previous registrars. I don't know. I mean, it's starting to give me a little bit of a headache here, but it's Barbara, go ahead.
Thank you, James. Barbara, for the record. So from my view, it seems to me that a complaint or transfer actually has two entities that could be parties, the gaining registrar and the losing registrar, and it seems to me that only those two parties would be the ones that would file a dispute relative to a transaction, even in a three, hop scenario, excuse me. So from my perspective, I do feel rather strongly that we could get rid of the registrar of record and not really lose anything here. In fact, I think it probably would be a little bit more accurate to say that the complaint is either going to be the losing registrar or the gaining registrar for a specific transaction that occurred in violation of the policy. My two cents.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. And I'm curious as to whether we believe that by leaving the registrar of record here, the language, I mentioned earlier that it doesn't seem to do any harm. Well, it could if we are controlling access, defining who has access to file a complaint or who has standing. And I don't know that we are doing that with the definitions, but I could be wrong. Volker?
Old hand, sorry.
Okay, thanks, Volker. Well, I don't know that we've really come down on anything here about taking it in there, leaving it in there or taking it out. In general, I agree with Barbara, is that in any imaginable situation, the registrar of record would fall under one of the other categories, either losing registrar or gaining registrar. And to be consistent with the language of the IRTP wouldn't be that we would remove registrar of record. We would actually remove losing registrar. I don't. Well, let me think here. Anyway, we're getting close to the top of the hour here. Lars, I think that we definitely want to put in an or, but I think we're probably going to have to move this to the list. I don't think that we can solve this here in the next 8 minutes. I think that, you know, the let me say that we should probably very clearly articulate the scenario where a registrar that is currently the sponsor of the domain name but was not a party to the fraudulent transfer can raise a complaint about a previous transfer. And I think that that is not only rare, but could, and I think Volker touched on this, could open up the potential for abuse. And I'm looking perhaps to our aftermarket participants as well to think through the ways that that could be gamed, you know, in a negative way here, where a registrar of record might challenge a previous transfer, a previous you know, sale or transaction of a domain name. I think that that's something that maybe should factor into our consideration. So I'm going to have to drop here. I think that we have time maybe for one more, and I think Lars would be glad to take the wheel for a respondent and go from there. I think that's fairly clear. But Lars, if you would, and then thanks everyone for your time. We'll certainly follow up with some action items on the list and really encourage registrars to get some statistics on the FOA because that was the bulk of our conversation today. So thank you, everyone, and I will turn it over to Lars.
Thanks, James. This is Lars for the record. As James just said, the next item on here is the respondent. As you can see, the definition would be a party against which a complaint is brought. Looks straightforward for me, but I'm opening up, obviously, to the floor for any comments. Barbara agrees. I've got a check mark. Christine, over to you.
Yeah, this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. I don't agree at all. I don't disagree at all. I just wanted to throw out there, since we've been fairly specific with complainant, if we want to also make it clear that that is that the party against which a complaint is brought could be one of those same registrars, including the registrar of record in this case. At a minimum, I'm just making the suggestion, even if we decide not to elaborate, if we want to say a registrar against which a complaint is brought. Because, again, you know, the respondent's not just anybody. It's another registrar. So just a point of clarification, probably not a big deal, and I would certainly not object to leaving it the way it is. I just thought I'd throw that out there in the interest of, you know, making things a little more complicated than they need to be.
Thank you for that. I think Barbara in the chat pointed out that that she thought it was a good point. So I'm very happy to change it for the next draft, to change party to registrar. Anybody in the group who would like to comment on that? No. Yes, Chris agrees in the chat. I suppose we have time for one more, maybe even two. The next one down the line is complaint. The initial document in the TDRP proceeding that provides the allegations and claims brought by the complainant against the respondent. Is there time to read that through again? Christine put a check mark into the chat. Barbara as well. No hands raised. More check marks, Bob and Chris. Okay, I'm moving on to the next one, dispute resolution panel. The dispute resolution panel shall mean an administrative panel appointed by a dispute resolution provider in brackets, to decide a request for enforcement concerning a dispute under this dispute resolution policy. Christine, got your hands up? Over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Christine, for the record from National Arbitration Forum. I think this is actually a vestigial definition, and I think it's inaccurate. So there's a couple of problems. First of all, I do not believe we have decided for sure whether or not the registry is going to continue to do request enforcement. Correct me if I'm wrong. I did miss a couple of phone calls. So I want to make it clear that a dispute resolution panel would not include that because I think the registry just uses their own internal people. Secondly, which may or may not need to be as part of the definition, that's just sort of my preamble. So here's my main comment. My main comment is that the provider not only decides requests for enforcement, but also decides the appeals. And so based on however we, you know, whatever the outcome is, whether or not we're moving to a just provider system, or we're not moving to a just provider system, we're going to have to figure out this definition because there may be requests for enforcement, there may be appeals. So ultimately, we may not be able to answer this at the end of the day till we know exactly what the format is going to be, but I think we're going to need to do something with this definition to clarify it because it is not clear the way it's currently worded and never has been.
Thank you for that, Christine. I agree, it would probably make sense, and you're right, we have not, so the group has not yet settled definitely on whether or not to abandon, as it were, the registry as the first level dispute providers. So it might be best to maybe move this to the end of the line and circle back to it once we've settled on that, on the recommendation as well. Anybody else on this? Barbara, so earlier, agreed with Christine's comments. And if there's no other hands that are being raised, I think I'm going to call it to a close with just about under a minute left. I believe we settled on not meeting next week due to the bank holiday in the UK and the public holiday, Memorial Day, I believe, in the United States. So this would mean we will meet next on the 2nd of July at the same time at 15 UTC. I'm looking forward to discussion on the list. I'll put out some reminders to the registrars for the FOA data and also on the definition of the complainant. Thank you very much, everybody, and I'll speak to you in 2 weeks' time, if not before then. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Lars. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you.